You should know off the top that I love comic book movies.
No offense, but I don't play well with others.
Big man in a suit of armor. Take that away, what are you?
Genius, billionaire, playboy, philanthropist.
But I also hate them. Because it's hard to love a bully. So today, as the latest, biggest, and longest, and most important comic book movie ever arrives in theaters to shatter box office records, obliterate competition, and remind us that there are no other blockbusters anymore, we need to ask, how did Hollywood end up like this? And now that we're here, is there any way it changes?
Why would you do that? We're in the end game now.
Movies are an art, but they are, above all, a business. And superhero movies make money, a lot of money, always. So they'll keep being made as long as we keep forking over the cash for tickets. Will we ever stop? How did we get so addicted to the formula that these movies follow anyway? What is in Marvel's secret sauce that has made this genre the most dominant in decades, and perhaps ever? Oh, and is Avengers Endgame any good? We will answer that for you too, even if, let's be real, you're going to see it anyway. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Norm Willner is the senior film writer for Now Magazine. He is also the host of a podcast called Someone Else's Movie, and he has, by virtue of this being his job, already seen Avengers Endgame. Hi, Norm.
Hi. Well, this is Friday, right? So people have seen it. There are people seeing it right now in a theater somewhere as this episode drops, which is mind-boggling to me.
So we're going to talk about the business of this movie and all comic book movies. But first, for the people who didn't rush out at midnight on Thursday night to see it, I would like you to give me two reviews of this film. Very short. The first for the diehard Marvel fan who goes to all the superhero movies and loves them and will this be a satisfying ending? And then secondly, for the person who's probably seen some of them and is definitely going to get dragged along by that first person.
I'll do the second one first, which is ask your friend everything. Be that annoying person who says, who's that again? What's this? Why am I watching this? Because this is not a movie for the newbie. It's like, I wrote about this. I mean, it would be as pointless for a newcomer to start here as it would be for someone to watch the last two Harry Potter movies or The Return of the King, which is the film I think most people will be comparing this to. It is a climax. It's not entirely climactic. I mean, there's stuff in it that happens. It has a beginning, middle, and end. But if you are coming in relatively fresh, if you've only seen a couple of the Avengers movies and maybe one of the Captain Americas, you're going to get lost. You're going to be floundered. You're going to wonder where everybody is. Half the cast was killed in the previous Avengers movie, Infinity War. Spoilers, half of all life in the universe was killed. And so what we have here is more of a leftovers meditation on superherodom. What happens when heroes have nothing to do? What happens when you've been defeated so badly that you can't imagine fighting on? Captain America's signature line is that he'll always get back up because I can do this all day. This is what happens when you don't have a reason to get back up. And that's really interesting. And then it turns into some other stuff that is incredibly entertaining and will, again, be further alienating to people who haven't seen all 21 or at least like 17 of these movies.
So it's satisfying then for the utter Marvel geeks among us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody but Uatu the Watcher shows up in this thing. It's a massive production. Actually, no. You know what? Now I realize I can't say everybody because now Disney owns X-Men and Fantastic Four and everybody's been hoping they'll show up. They do not. They didn't have the rights when they made the movie. Everybody has to stop expecting the impossible from these things. It is good enough, honestly, that you're getting a capstone to 11 years of movies that actually works as its own narrative, that actually functions and pays off these arcs that have been built since 2008 and 2010. It's a satisfying film. It is 3 hours long. It feels half as long as the last one, which was 2.5 hours long and felt like four. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the quantum math works out on this one.
So you called it a film a whole bunch of times.
It is a film.
In those reviews.
But it's a motion picture.
How much of it is well-made cinema, and how much of this movie exists as an industry unto itself, a marketing gimmick, an amusement park ride, everything that we currently associate with this genre that has taken over Hollywood?
Yeah, that's fair. I would say most of it, just because the thing that Marvel did that just as a comparison DC didn't do, when they launched their new wave of superhero franchise films to compete directly with Marvel. The thing that Marvel did was cast actors, not movie stars necessarily, and they cast or they hired filmmakers and writers who would drive this stuff with give these things emotional stakes. You know, the first Thor is a fish out of water comedy because otherwise it would be a dull, stentorian movie with people in cloaks punching each other. Mm-hmm. Instead, they put him in a black t-shirt and jeans and make him fart around New Mexico for a while, and it's really entertaining. It also gives him a level of humanity that the character needs to exist in the real, you know, quote-unquote real world. Marvel's greatest move, which they have since retconned, that's retroactive continuity for people who've never heard that term. I only learned about it in the 90s, which is subsequently you say that this thing we thought we did that didn't work out was actually all part of our plan. The first thing they did that was brilliant about Iron Man was they set it in the present day in the real world. America was in Afghanistan. 9/11 had happened. There were no superheroes. And it was about a guy building himself a suit that makes him the world's first superhero and how that works. And then, of course, because it was part of this larger project, there had to be more heroes, there had to be more villains, there had to be super everythings. And subsequently, we found out that Captain America was around in the 40s and that Ant-Man was around in the 60s. And there have been flashbacks to the 80s and flashbacks to the 90s and back and forth. Captain Marvel, which just came out this year,
yep,
is a little piece of retconning that allows for a superpowered person to be flying around in Los Angeles in the 90s, which no one remembers. But, you know, whatever. There was other stuff going on. S.H.I.E.L.D. has always been there to write these things off. So they've had to build this entire infrastructure to pay off in this film. But they did it by basing things in vulnerability and humanity and comedy in a way that no other superhero franchise had really allowed for. Richard Donner's Superman did it the first time in 78. And Superman 2 picked up on it in 81. And then they sort of botched the balance and they stopped being fun. But those first two movies, I think, are the template. If you want to create a franchise that people will come back to, you have to make them care about everybody in the character, not just the suit. That awareness of humanity and that need to constantly connect to the people in the action scenes is the thing that Marvel figured out they needed to do before anybody else did.
To what extent have they taken over the entire movie business? I mean, you've covered film for decades.
Yep.
As Marvel movies in particular, but also superhero movies in general, have become more and more lucrative and more popular and et cetera, what has that done to the rest of the film industry? What percentage does Marvel own now?
Yeah, it's kind of obliterated the competition. The concept of the event movie is now either a Marvel movie or a Transformers movie or maybe a DC film if they can get the marketing right. Like Shazam and Aquaman have actually done a lot to right that ship. But one of the biggest issues of the Marvel movies is that if you're going to release three of these every year, as they have done for the last little while, the industry quickly learns to get out of the way. So
what does that look like when they get out of the way?
It means Fast and the Furious movies come out in April now. They used to be summer films. It means if Spider-Man stakes a claim, there's nothing on either side of it because no one will care. It means the 4th of July weekend isn't the 4th of July weekend anymore. It used to be when Will Smith put his movies out. That was sort of a fun little deal he had. Mm-hmm. And I think this year Men in Black International is coming close, although Smith's not in it, just as a sort of habit. But it has changed the landscape of the film release calendar, and it has changed the landscapes of what studios make and what they consider worthy of really pushing, really promoting. You don't get a lot of original product anymore. You don't get a lot of original ideas. Jordan Peele's Us, probably the most recent one, to actually make a dent in the box office as well as be, you know, worth going out to see. And that is in large part the success of the Marvel project, but also just the general trend towards gargantuan movies that justify the ticket price. If you're spending $25 on an IMAX seat,
right,
or whatever 4DX costs, we talked about this last time, you have to find a reason to justify that in your mind. No one is going to gamble on, or the thinking is that no one is going to gamble $25 on an unknown quantity. So it better have a product line that you're familiar with or a childhood memory that you like, or, you know, Dumbo underperformed, but it still made millions of dollars because of the name. I don't think Tim Burton's Dumbo was the thing that got people in. It's the live action Dumbo, and there's going to be a live action Aladdin next month and
right,
Lion King after that. We are in an age of recycled blockbusters that Marvel managed to use to its advantage because their event movies are actually delivering the things that people want.
Do you remember when you first realized that this kind of shift was happening? That, again, Marvel in particular, but let's talk about all superhero movies just because they're the dominant force. When you realized that this would be the new normal, that, you, like you said, the 3, 4, 5 movies a year, all blockbusters, all featuring comic book characters.
I think it would have been around the time that Iron Man 2 came out and it tanked. Or it didn't tank, sorry. No, it made money, but it wasn't very good.
Yeah.
Nobody liked it. And you could tell that nobody liked it, and you could also tell that Marvel wasn't going to stop. That they were announcing 5 other films, and that, I think right around that time is when DC said they were going to rework Superman again, just after Superman Returns had failed to inspire love and joy in anybody but me, apparently. And they said, no, we're going to keep doing this. We have a plan. We're going to the Avengers. We're going to keep going. We're going to keep making these movies. And after the Avengers, we have Ant-Man. And after that, we have this. And after this, we have that. And you saw these, they were talking in phases. And because they were successful financially, everyone just allowed it to happen. I mean, it just sort of went along with it. Disney didn't take over until The Avengers, I think, was the first film released by Disney after they acquired Marvel Studios. Paramount released the Iron Man films before that, and Thor, and Hulk came out of Universal. And then when you realize that they were consolidating, like, that had never happened before. The idea that one company now not only owned all these characters, but all the movies.
Yeah.
Because previously, over the late 90s and early 2000s, you couldn't get a Marvel movie made to save your life. Fox got the rights to a couple of things. Sony got Spider-Man. And all the other, like the Punisher, was scattered out to independent
productions. You couldn't do the interactions, which are so key to that, like, shared universe
and
concept.
No one had ever attempted anything like it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, Batman Forever, I think, had a joke about how the train is halfway from Gotham to Metropolis by now. And people were like, Superman! It's like, no, you're not going to see Superman. Don't be silly. That's impossible. That's ridiculous. And now that happens on a regular basis.
Now there literally better be 25 different characters in this Endgame movie, or I'm going to be disappointed.
There's at least, I mean, if you just want to talk about the aliens, there's at least that many. But the other thing, too, is the sense of impermanence that it brings with it because, again, not a spoiler, but if Infinity War ends with the deaths, the erasures of Spider-Man, Doctor Strange, half the Guardians, most of the Guardians of the Galaxy, and the Black Panther, all of whom have projects in development, it can't stick, right? We know Spider-Man Homecoming? No, Far From Home is coming out in July, August? It's finished. It's done. Between Infinity War and this, people were talking about, you know, Tom Holland not being able to be trusted with spoilers while shooting another Spider-Man movie.
Yeah, he's probably going to live.
The marketing, exactly, or he'll come back in some form. The marketing makes it impossible to fully invest in these movies, and that's kind of why Endgame is so impressive, is that it finds emotional beats that can't be spoiled, in a way, by what you know.
How unprecedented is this kind of genre takeover of Hollywood? Has this happened to this extent before in cinema, where one type of movie comes to dominate all box office life?
It sort of did in the 80s. Science fiction was everywhere after Star Wars in all sorts of weird permutations. You had teens and sci-fi. You had, like, Back to the Future, which
right.
is its own kind of genre. Wasn't the first of that ilk. It was just the best. There were endless attempts to incorporate it into, you know, Alien produced The Thing in the 80s and sci-fi horror, and it was cheap to make. I think the difference here is that it's all coming from studios, that only motion picture studios can afford to make these movies properly because they cost upwards of Endgame. I don't know how much it costs, but I think the average superhero film now costs around $140, $160 million, which is incomprehensible, but it pulls in, you know, $600 million to $1 billion. It's always worth the investment until one of these absolutely tanks and they can find a reason not to make another one just like it, but there'll be 3 more in the pipeline. That won't change. As long as the return on investment is so strong, it will be desirable for everyone to do it. Universal doesn't have a superhero franchise, but they have Shyamalan with Glass kind of making a sequel to, well, not kind of, literally making a sequel to Unbreakable and Split.
Those
and
are superhero movies.
They are superhero movies. They don't want to be, which is why they don't work. Ultimately, Unbreakable works because no one knew what it was. And now he's still making them that way, and they're very frustrating and also really badly written. But I think Glass still made money because it wasn't – or turned a profit, rather, because it wasn't expensive. He made it on the cheap for Blumhouse and Universal. But if Universal could get their hands on a property that was that big that isn't Fast and Furious, which are superhero movies now, they right. would do it in a second. I think the connection of Marvel to Disney and DC to Warner defines those relationships more than they used to, certainly. But it means that everybody else, the remaining studios, are going to be looking for the next thing, and it's going to be very, very similar.
What would it take? I think you briefly touched on it. But what would it take for this genre of film to get knocked down the totem pole a little bit, or to move over and make way for some other films to get more notoriety? would you have to see a bunch of them tanking in the row? Will they ever run out of superheroes? Like, what does the future look like?
I think the future looks like this. The future
forever?
I think we're living in it for the time being until someone radically reinvents the cinematic experience. The reason to go to a movie theater will be one of these things. And they're trying to reinvent the cinematic experience with this 4DX thing, which is just awful.
This is the 4DX experience, very briefly for people who don't know what it is.
It's like a theme park seats for a movie. So it's if you've ever done the Jurassic Park ride at Universal or you know, Space Mountain or something, it's you watch the film as it is, but it's been enhanced with 3D and then the additional, I hate talking about this, environmental effects. So there'll be puffs of air at the back of your ear to simulate a knock on the back of the character's head.
That sounds
horrible. It's the worst. I saw Doctor Strange in it and I had already seen the film. So it was possible to watch it objectively, I guess, as the process. And other people who hadn't seen the film and were very excited to see Doctor Strange were basically all car sick 20 minutes in. Because the seats move and rock and drift and that's horrible.
Okay, so assuming that's not the future of film.
And it's expensive. It's too expensive to implement on a large scale. All 4DX rooms are something like 50 seats at most. They convert small spaces into it. I don't know what there is that isn't this anymore.
That's really depressing.
It can be. I think as long as they're casting actors I like, I continue, and who are interesting, I'm going to continue to be interested, right? Brie Larson as Captain Marvel is a great choice. She gave a performance that is largely internal in a superhero movie, and it pays off beautifully. And that's perceived as frustrating somehow. I don't know. I mean, obviously people didn't like Captain Marvel because it was a lady superhero movie, and that's a whole thing.
Here's the thing. I love comic books.
Yeah.
I enjoy these movies, and I rewatch them. But it still feels frustrating on a level to hear someone like you who cares so deeply about all kinds of film say that the future looks just like more of this as far as the eye can see. How does that make you feel about what you do?
It's kind of depressing. I won't lie. I will say, you know, the same week that Endgame arrives in, I don't know, a billion movie screens, David Robert Mitchell's follow-up to It Follows, Under the Silver Lake, which premiered at Cannes last year, was received with mixed reviews and bumped around the schedule in the U.S. by A24 and Mongrel Media, which distributes the film here, is kind of hostage to what they do. David Robert Mitchell's movie is being dumped into a single screen in the Carlton, where it will wither and die. It'll be on VOD a week later. It might already be on iTunes now, actually. And that is a shame because it is a great, weird, oddball, neo-noir, unquantifiable mystery. I mean, I've just quantified it, but it is... It is a ride. It is a very, very strange film. It's also objectively too weird for people to see. It was never going to be a blockbuster. It was never going to be a hit.
Sure.
But it definitely deserves a theatrical run. And it's the sort of experience that will be diminished if you watch it at home with your phone or distracted by, you know, the dog or the cat or the kids or whatever else is going on. Also, you don't want children in the room with this film. It is the kind of grown-up swing for the fences that people only make because they've had a hit before. And the fact that it isn't given a chance to stand on its own, through no fault of Mongrels, their hands were tied. But in Canada, it is playing in one screen and then it's going away. And that is a heartbreaker. I can write the review. I can make people aware of it, which I did. I can bring it up now and tell people, go see this. Endgame will still be there on Tuesday or whenever you catch up to it. It will be no different. Movies don't change. They're fixed in time. Under the Silver Lake will also be the same when you catch up to it, but it won't be a big enveloping experience the way it's supposed to be. Even at the Carlton, which, you know, they're not bad screens. They're just small. People make the calculus of, well, that theater's pretty small. My TV's pretty big and I have HD. I'll just wait for streaming or I'll buy it on iTunes or rent it and I'll get the Blu-ray and I'll watch it at home. And you are cheating yourself of the experience of being locked in the dark with the thing. We have seen over 10 years, more really, I mean, this started with the Lord of the Rings films probably, we have seen a split between what people are willing to pay to see in a theater and what people would prefer to watch at home because it saves you the trip, it saves you the time, you can make your own popcorn, TV.
Oh, my TV's really good now.
Yeah, televisions are at a point now where they are good enough. They're good enough. They're great. I have a projection set up. I have Dolby Atmos. You know, I can write all that off, but I have it, and it's pretty great, and I can watch stuff on a 120-inch screen, and it looks pretty great, and I'm very happy that I don't have to walk more than 10 feet. But I will still go see a movie in a theater if I can because that's how you're supposed to see them. You're supposed to interact with these things on a screen as art or even entertainment, but you're supposed to be locked in a room with a lot of people all having the same experience as you. And the superhero movies give people that.
Exactly that.
It's their tribe. It's their team. Like I tweeted about this years ago, and it got picked up a little bit. DC and Marvel have basically become sports teams that we are rooting for or perceived to be rooting for in our own ways. And you can't like both. That's a rule that I'm reminded of many, many times when people accuse me of taking Disney money not to like Warner films. Or if I like a DC movie, I must have been able to break the shackles of the corporate masters or something, because, you know, it can't possibly be that some of them are better than others. It can't possibly be that Marvel has weak films and DC has great ones, and you can never tell until you sit down and watch the damn thing. But the rooting and the you know, there's a moment in Endgame that will bring the house down for a lot of people. And for some of the other people, they're going to see it as an offense to them because it's not exactly what they want the way they want it. I will not spoil this moment. I will only say that you will know it when you see it. And if you don't thrill to it, then you're playing for the wrong team. And that's the feeling you get in the room. And the press screening, people cheered. It's going to be a weird experience for people. And it builds on something that's been in the culture for a very long time that I can't talk about it without spoiling it. But it's something that we need to be aware of and to embrace when it happens. And again, that's all part of the need to seat in a theater. You need to be part of the group that cheers or part of the group that sees the thing. And that's where these films have triumphed in a way that conventional cinema just doesn't offer. Smaller films don't compete on the same field because they are, by definition, not super.
Last question. Even if, and I'm glad it's not on a personal level, but even if Avengers Endgame was awful, would it matter to Marvel, to Disney, to the future of Hollywood?
I think the expense of this specific film means it's going to have to make a great deal of money. I think that will happen. And I think that would have happened regardless of its quality. The gotta see factor, the idea that this is the movie you've been waiting for, especially after Infinity War denied you the big triumphant Avengers Assemble that everyone wants from these things anyway, it is great. It would not have mattered if it wasn't. Justice League was abysmal. They made more. Mm-hmm. They found ways to make it without the Justice League thing. The next two DC films were standalones. That was already in the pipeline. That was already going to happen, but they fast-tracked them and probably steered them in a certain way to keep the larger connections remote at a distance. There, you know, Batman is mentioned in Shazam, and Aquaman obviously knows the Justice League but doesn't want to play with them anymore. That's how they get into an origin story for a character who's already appeared in two films.
Yeah.
But the machinery of these things is so big that they'll just try to course correct in a way instead of actually stop and start over. Because starting over brings its own scandal, right? When Ben Affleck drops out as Batman, it's because it's a failure. It's not a failure on his part. He played a character in a certain way. People didn't like it. That's a choice that's rejected. With Marvel, there haven't been as many egregious miscasting or complications or problems. My biggest disappointment, and I guess this is technically a spoiler, is that Hannah Jun Common doesn't come back after Ant-Man and the Wasp because she was a really interesting character who was neither hero nor villain, and she would have been interesting to see in this. But it's so big that there's no time for secondary minor villains.
It's too big to fail, like the Banks.
Well, there is that. You cannot, but in this case, it's weird. The Banks is a bad comparison just because they are literally out to take our money and give us nothing in return. The Marvel movies are movies. You pay your ticket, you see a movie. That's the contract.
I'm not getting anything truly original and great and cinematic in return. I know exactly what I'm getting.
Sure, but that's the reason these films deliver, right, when they're good. It's because they reaffirm whatever your love for those characters is. There's a thing that you keep coming back to in the characters that resonates with you if you care about a character. And these movies have found a way to harness that and use it for, you know, for good. The idea that Captain America is so simply defined by kindness and resilience, and that Chris Evans finds a way to make that interesting movie after movie after movie, and that these films, as they've progressed, and specifically Endgame, find a way for all the characters to literally look back on who they were and who they are now and be aware and let us be aware of the growth or the lack of growth is really interesting. And in a 3-hour action movie, it's kind of incredible that they took the time when every frame of film is hyper expensive and obviously 2 hours would be better. It's sort of great that there's the awareness and the artistry to reflect on this stuff. Even if they do it in a serio comic way in the second act, it's really nice to see that they didn't just crank it out. They made a movie that does serve as a capstone. There will be more, of course there will, but this is a good one to, if you're done, this is a good one to go out on. I'll put it that way.
Thanks, Norm.
My pleasure.
Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine. Also, check out his podcast, Someone Else's Movie, when you get a chance. And check out our other episodes of this podcast at thebigstorypodcast.ca or our other podcasts, Moms in the Middle coming back for season 2. You can find it at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. If you want to talk to us, we are on all your social media platforms at Frequency Pods. And just this show is on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. Come and listen, subscribe for free wherever you get podcasts, on Apple, on Google, on Stitcher, on Spotify, on Podcruncher, which sounds fun. Claire Broussard is the lead producer of The Big Story. Ryan Clark is our associate producer. Annalisa Nielsen is our digital editor. The fantastic Stephanie Phillips is on vacation right now, but she'll be back soon. And I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk on Monday.